This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Stephen C. Kramer versus Louisville Memorial Hospital from Denton County. The Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company versus Hortensia Partilla from Calhoun County. And Metter Brady Management Corporation versus the Texas Motor Vehicle Commission and others from Cravath County. In each of these arguments, there has been time allotted for petitioners and respondents to present arguments. You have been advised of those times, and the petitioner may reserve a portion of the time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of the court. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments and will, of course, complete the arguments before the noon break. Justice Heck is away from the court this morning at a funeral, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision in all these causes. Justice Enoth is recused in Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company versus Partilla, and I also will not be here for at least that argument because of pressing business over in the legislature, which I could not get them to reschedule. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Kramer versus Louisville Memorial Hospital.
May it please the court, petitioner is represented by Mr. Bruce Pauley and Mr. Michael Box. Mr. Pauley will open argument. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal to be presented by Mr. Box.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, this is a case of lost chance of survival and is a case of first impression before this court. Over the course of our lifetimes, medical science has given patients a real chance to recover, sometimes only a small chance, but a real chance all the same in circumstances that used to be hopeless. When patients go to doctors with serious illnesses, they expect to have these chances which medical science has provided. The loss of chance doctrine addresses those situations where a healthcare provider's negligence has deprived the patient of all or a part of those chances. The doctrine of loss of chance that is before the court, we hope the decision before the court this morning is what form to adopt loss of chance as opposed to whether or not to adopt loss of chance. The doctrine has been held in two extremes with numerous cases in the middle. The one extreme is espoused by the respondent in this case, that being the all-or-nothing approach. That is, if you cannot prove to a reasonable medical probability that the conduct of the healthcare provider proximately caused the death or injury of the complaining party, then there is no recovery. The other extreme is the some loss of chance and full recovery, which is the Kallenberg case out of New York, the Hastings and other cases out of Louisiana, which essentially say that if you prove that the healthcare provider diminished some chance of survival of the decedent, then the heirs are entitled to a full recovery. What we are urging the court is to take a middle ground in this situation and find that either loss of chance is a new cause of action in the state of Texas, or find under the Restatement 323 theory, or find the third avenue, which is a substantial chance relaxed causation outside of the Restatement of Torts 323.
Does this theory apply to any cause of action other than health care provider malpractice?
Your Honor, I believe that there could be circumstances where it would, and certainly in other professional situations, architects, engineers, even perhaps lawyers, although quite frankly I have trouble formulating a hypothetical to present to the court.
How about our lost profits doctrine, which is we've always fairly rigorously confined in new businesses to businesses who could show they were going to succeed for some reason or another. Two-thirds of all restaurants fail, but for some reason you're not properly funded or a sign isn't painted right or your menu's misprinted, could you show that your chance of success
or that
your new restaurant was relaxed from 20% to 15, and
or that you don't get your Yellow Page ad put in the in
yes,
the book.
I
suppose that that argument could be made. I would think that the proof would be extremely problematical. The reason that this cause of action applies primarily in the case law, at least in medical malpractice situations, is because the profession has so much empirical data based upon epidemiological studies that have been performed that it is prone to quantification through statistics, probabilities, and in a lot of the cases, just percentage testimony that the chance has been lost of from, say, 60% down to 30%.
Does loss of chance include acceleration of death?
I would think, Your Honor, that it possibly could, but the result, the loss of chance, the way I understand the doctrine, is that the injury is the loss of chance, not the death or disability, and the injury finally accrues upon the death or the disability. I'm not sure that that addresses your question, but
I guess what I'm wondering is part of the policy reasons that you're arguing for our adoption of loss of chance that persons are inadequately compensated when they're going to die anyway, but the medical malpractice accelerates their demise as opposed to...
Well, we've got to first start with the premise that we're all going to die anyway, and the medical malpractice situation is typically where you have a cancer or a heart patient, and given the state of the art of medicine, they're going to have a 45% recovery if they're diagnosed at a given point in time, but absent that diagnosis, their chances go down to 20 or 10%. That doesn't necessarily result in the acceleration of death. What we're dealing with is whether they have a chance of the prevention of death, at least for the statistical period that these studies are done, typically 5 or 10 years, or whether or not they're deprived of any chance whatsoever.
If we are to look for a middle ground between an all or nothing proposition, why should that middle ground include a case such as this, in which I understand that there was evidence that there was, or there was testimony at least, that there was reasonable medical probability that there was actual causation of death here?
The testimony in this case, Your Honor, took very extreme positions. There was testimony that it was a stage 1 cancer with a 95% chance of survival. There was testimony it was a stage 4 cancer with a 0% chance of survival. There was testimony it was stage 2 and also stage 3, stage 2 being approximately 80% chance, stage 3 being something less than 50. We believe that the jury should have the opportunity to pick and choose which of the testimony it believes, as in every jury case. And in this circumstance, they could choose to believe that it was stage 2 and the reduction was to a stage 3, ergo a 30% loss.
Why, Ms. Polly, the jury, I guess, found against the Kramers on proximate cause based on reasonable medical probability, but this case appears to be a failure to diagnose.
That's
why
correct.
Why isn't the loss of chance subsumed in the broader negligence question? In other words, this was not a causation of the illness. This was a misdiagnosis or a failure to diagnose. There is testimony about reasonable medical probability appears in failing to diagnose that approximately caused her to finally suffer death. Why isn't a loss of chance submitted in this case not duplicative, good word, of the negligence, the general negligence question being asked? Because they didn't cause the injury. This is not a causation of injury as opposed to causation of loss of chance of survival. This is a misdiagnosis, which the ultimate injury is inability to survive. It is a loss of chance case.
Right. It's not subsumed, Your Honor, because the jury was not instructed. We were not given the opportunity to argue. Loss of chance. If had there been a proper instruction, and I might suggest to the court that one such instruction has been suggested by the commentator Darrell Keith in his Law Review article, that given that proper instruction, in the alternative, do you find that the proximate cause, that the negligence was the proximate cause of the death, or the loss of chance, if any, of survival, that it would be part and parcel of the same thing. In this case, we were only given the opportunity to argue the death.
But, well, I guess that goes back to my question. The only, I mean, the whole issue in this case was, had they diagnosed it correctly, she would have survived. And since this is a diagnosis case as opposed to an injury-caused case, isn't that in fact, by definition, a loss of chance?
Well,
if the doctors had done their job, she would have survived. Having failed to do their job, she didn't survive. Isn't that, in fact, the loss of chance? If you submitted loss of chance, all you're saying is the same thing, that their failure to diagnose in time reduced her opportunity to survive. I don't see how...
The difference... Let me first address the broad picture. In some cases, such as the Hamill case out of Pennsylvania, they allowed a cause of action for loss of chance even though there was a 95% chance of survival. In this case, we've got a situation, though, where the extremes aren't that polar, given the jury's opportunity believe that it was stage one or stage two cancer, which is ultimately reduced to a stage three by the misdiagnosis, which leaves you not the 95% chance of survival that I believe you envision, or even the 51% chance of survival that normally is considered to be reasonable medical probability, but you've got a 30% chance of survival, and that's what's being lost here, is not the probability of survival, but that 30% chance of survival.
What cause of action, I mean, under what authority are you bringing this lawsuit?
It was brought under the Wrongful Death and Survivor Act, Sean.
And doesn't the Wrongful Death, let's separate them, doesn't
okay.
the Wrongful Death Act have a standard in it? Doesn't it say cause the death?
Let me back up. It was also pled as common law loss of chance. Okay. Just so I can clarify, it was pled as a wrongful death act, a survival act, and then there was a separate allegation of loss of chance.
Do you believe is there a way that under the Texas precedents we have that we could recognize a loss of chance doctrine consistent with the language in the Wrongful Death Act of cause the death of?
There is a way. And that way was the way suggested by Justice Pearson in his concurrence in the Herskovich case out of the state of Washington. And essentially, he treated the loss of chance as the injury. And that being the injury caused the death. That is perhaps the only jurisdiction that I'm aware of that treated it in that manner, but that is the way he treated it.
That's fairly metaphysical. I mean,
I agree.
Improbably metaphysical, it seems to me.
But that's no more metaphysical than the respondent's argument that the injury is the death itself, so if you substitute death for injury in the wrongful death statute, it reads that the death caused the death. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the common law, a common law action for this loss of opportunity. Which I guess doesn't really measure a death. It measures this as a separate tort.
Correct.
Could that same concept be used essentially to swallow up the Wrongful Death Act and the limitations that this court has traditionally recognized on that as a legislatively created right, not one created by us?
I see the Wrongful Death Act as limiting this cause of action as opposed to the other way around. I'm sorry, I guess I didn't address your question.
Well, all right, how do you see the Wrongful Death Act as limiting this cause of action?
Counsel, can you tell me why loss of chance isn't subsumed in the court's instruction that the negligence, or question whether the negligence is a proximate cause of the occurrence in question. Why isn't loss of chance subsumed in that question?
It could well be, given the opportunity to argue loss of chance and given the opportunity to instruct the jury as to what a loss of chance actually is.
Did you argue to the jury that had Ms. Nightingale and Dr. Burgess not been negligent, that Ms. Kramer would have had a better chance of being here today, or an argument along those lines?
Your Honor, I wasn't there and the argument wasn't recorded. I don't know exactly what they argued. I do know that the court did not give our requested issues, jury questions on loss of chance. And I believe that nobody argued it as a result of that.
Do you agree that a good, able advocate could argue a loss of chance under the court's instruction on proximate cause, that this was a proximate cause of the occurrence in question?
Given the right definition of loss of chance and inclusion of that element in the negligence proximate cause question, which was not given here.
So I guess your answer is that you cannot argue loss of chance under proximate cause.
You can, Your Honor. I think maybe we're splitting hairs here. And
okay.
I'm probably not making myself clear. If you insert in the did the negligence, if any, proximately cause the death and or reduction in chance, if you have that language, certainly it's arguable. If you just say, did it cause the death, then it becomes more problematic. It becomes quite difficult to argue because that gets you into the all or something concept of the Hastings cases and the New York case where you're arguing, well, this doctor, this hospital reduced this person's chance by 20%, therefore she ought to get full recovery.
Well, of course, the court instructed in this case, the question was such negligence a proximate cause, not was it the proximate cause? And my question is simply, can't you argue loss of chance under that question?
Some of the jurisdictions have gone along those lines.
And is it your interpretation that Texas prohibits that argument under that definition and question?
I don't believe that it prohibits it. I think it would be extremely confusing to the jury, given the lack of other instructions on what loss of chance is and what substantial chance of recovery might be. I agree, Your Honor, that the loss of chance could easily be a substantial factor, as set forth by this court in the Havner case, could be a substantial factor in causing the death, and thus it wouldn't be the sole proximate cause, it would be a proximate cause. But again, the jury would kind of be functioning in the dark, I believe, under that circumstance.
Let me try my question again.
Okay,
I thought about it a little bit. If loss of chance is a separate injury not related to the wrongful death and therefore not prohibited by the causation language in the wrongful death, is a loss of chance cause of action available to anyone who has suffered some chance reduction due to negligence, whatever, regardless of the ultimate outcome? In other words, due to my misdiagnosis, my chance is reduced from 90 to 85%, but I'm one of the lucky ones that falls within the 85%, and I survive and make a complete recovery. I still, under your theory, have this cause of action, do I not?
Theoretically, you do, Your Honor, but the way that we have asked the court to view this is that the loss of chance damages accrue upon the death of the individual or upon the substantial harm, say paralysis or something along those lines.
The damages don't accrue until that point in time. Why doesn't this become a subterfuge around the wrongful death act? I mean, if it's not available to the lucky survivor, with in fact the same measure that I assume is the mental anguish and et cetera, it seems to me it stops being a cognizable separate injury and starts becoming a subterfuge.
Well, let me address it this way. Even if it were that way under the Wrongful Death Act, it should be a viable cause of action under the Survival Act. And this case was predicated on all three, common law, loss of chance, survival, and...
under the Survival Act.
Yes, there's different damages, of course.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I please report, Mr. Dean Davis, with an argument for respondents.
May it please the court. Justice Phillips and members of the court. It's interesting to hear the change in the petitioner's position from what at least we read in the briefs submitted. It seems that the petitioner is now urging a more moderate view than at least appears certainly either from the suggested submission to the jury with respect to instruction and special issues, and as they have briefed the case in both the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth and as we have read their brief for you. This is a tremendously important case, and your questions certainly indicate that that has not escaped any of you. It certainly has not escaped those that I represent. It is important and tremendously important, I'll repeat, if for no other reason, that it has within it the possibility of the most major change in the whole concept of negligence in this state in my 33 years of practice. Initially, there was a suggestion made in both the briefing, the argument, certainly in the argument of the amicus, that Texas courts were already recognizing loss of chance and had already talked about that. We cited the Valdez case, and I had either the fortune or misfortune of trying that case. The Valdez case taught me that the Valdez case was one where the court instructed after the close of plaintiff's evidence, and the case was appealed, and the case was sent back. The Valdez case taught me one important thing, and that is don't ask for victory too early. And that's an important lesson. The Valdez case had nothing to do with lost chance. It was not pled, it was not argued, it was not briefed. It was not even considered by the court. The court indeed espoused exactly the proper standard for submission of causation. And then Judge Nye went further and picked up some language, a beautiful language, that has been the suggestion that Texas in the Valdez case for the first time recognized a loss of chance. It did not. And it has not in any case before or since.
Do you believe we can then reject the position of the petitioners here and still act consistently with the language in Valdez that if someone's death is extended by even or caused by even an hour, minutes, or seconds, that the healthcare institution can be liable for that?
Justice Doggett, I think you can reject petitioner's position in this case and be extremely consistent with what was held in Valdez. You cannot reject petitioner's position in this case and not go contrary to the victim in Valdez. And that's the distinction I'm trying to make.
So you disagree with the dicta that I was referring to, that if the hospital accelerated the death by even an hour, minute, or seconds, it could be liable for that.
Risking some suggestion of insensitivity, I suggest that our system, in my judgment, cannot survive if we take the position that every tear and every bad day and every concern is compensable. I think this is why we have learned, and I think learned well, that the issue of probability, did it more than likely happen that the health care provider was negligent and that negligence caused the injury? The suggestion of probability, the requirement of probability, medical probability in these kinds of cases, has given the jury the ability to calculate in tremendously important and complicated cases the issue of justice. And not totally, but in my judgment, appropriate.
Yes, there are many diseases now, especially in the cancer area, that are very slow, leukemia and some others. If someone can show that with better and more prompt diagnosis, they could have lived 5 years, and instead they live 6 months, would you still say that is not compensable? But if the ultimate outcome is death from this disease, then it doesn't matter how quickly or how slowly that occurs. I'm taking Valdez to its other extreme from a second.
I know, Your Honor, and I'm not sure I have either an instructive or helpful response to that. This case is a great demonstrator of what Your Honor is suggesting, because one of the reasons that the testimony in this case varied all over the lot from a phase 1 to a phase 4 cancer is the way the experts approached the analysis of what that cancer was at the time that Ms. Kramer presented to her physician in August of 85. One of the plaintiff's experts did a clinical analysis. In this kind of a cancer, a tremendously difficult opportunity either to discover microscopically or by physical examination. On the other hand, the defense experts did an analysis based upon actually examining the cancer, knowing at the time it was finally discovered what it was, where it was, and how it reached from the cervix to the lungs. And based upon their experience, they knew, because of the doubling time of this kind of cancer, how they could approximate closely the date. And this is the reason for the range. And so I guess the suggestion is that in the area of cancer, the detectability of it and the methodology by which it's detected can vary such that it's not surprising that the experts differ. What is important is that the jury got to hear all of that. The jury heard all of that. The jury did not find the physician pathologist negligent, nor did they find our employee negligent. They found the hospital negligent because they allowed the employee to take the slides home to try to increase the turnaround time. But they found no proximate cause for the hospital.
Were those issues submitted separately, or were they subsumed in the discussion?
Separate.
So if Ms. Kramer would have lived for a year longer had the cancer been diagnosed at the time when her lawyers argued to the jury it should have been, is that not compensable?
If she had lived a year longer?
Her loss of a year of her life, is that a compensable element of damage?
Within the framework of the instruction, approximate cause as to medical probability, yes. But only, in my judgment, in that framework.
And you, is that because you think that is an element of proximate cause as the jury was instructed in this case?
I do, Judge.
This cause of action has been recognized in a number of other states.
Yes, sir.
In fact, if we fail to recognize it, we would probably join a minority of the states that have acted on, that have had this question before them so far. Is that your reading?
Not exactly, Judge Phillips. I I think counsel has properly given you the spectrum, and it truly goes all the way from a brand new cause of action to brand new damages to just a part approximate cause. And so, depending on where you fit these things, as I read their position all the way from the trial court to their briefing before you, I put them on the edge where there are six other states only. I read what they submitted this morning, and as authorities for dealing with lost chance, and I looked over those, and I have to be a bit amused, and if this is an example of the accuracy, I have some severe questions with it. They list under Maryland the Fennell case versus Southern Maryland Hospital. The court in that case provided us with a stinging denunciation of the whole concept. And they list it as maybe. It's the strongest opinion that we have cited. And to list that as maybe, if you list it that way, I think it's a severe misread.
Well, I haven't gotten to my real question yet.
Yes, sir.
Have you or have you seen any studies undertaken of these states where it is clearly recognized, perhaps just the six states, to see what difference that makes in the overall development of the law, what difference it makes in medical malpractice, if this concept has been applied in other types of lawsuits other than medical malpractice?
Your Honor, I have not seen done any study of that nature. That suggests to me one of the major concerns that we have, and that is the fact that that has not been done. In my judgment, this is the kind of issue this morning that has incredible public policy overtones. And those kinds of studies, in order to address a major change in the handling of something as important as negligence cases in this state, would suggest to me that that's the kind of a study, if a public policy change is in the offing, that ought to be made. I don't know that it's been made in any state. It certainly has not been made in this one, and it certainly has not been made in any of the states that where we have briefed. Our information has come, I gather, as counsel's has, just from the reading of the cases.
Mr. Davis?
Yes, sir.
Justice Enoch and Cornyn both alluded, I think, to the question of whether or not a loss of chance would in reality be subsumed in a failure to diagnose cause of action and the jury instructions on proximate cause of that cause of action, if I understood the questions correctly. And the other side responded that indeed, it would had they been given the opportunity to argue it and had the jury been properly instructed on it. Are you arguing that it would be inappropriate to give a loss of chance instruction on a failure to diagnose and on proximate cause subsumed in the failure to diagnose? In other words, are you arguing that we not recognize in any form, even as an integral part of a recognized cause of action, the failure to diagnose a loss of chance at life for someone?
Judge Gibbons, let me answer the question this way. In 30 years of trying to do this, plus, distinguished counsel on the other side of the table from me have never passed up an opportunity to argue that. Never.
But if I understand them correctly, they said they were deprived of.
I wasn't there and didn't argue either. But I cannot believe that Les Wiesbrod did not argue the value of Ms. Kramer's life. It's inconceivable to me that he didn't. And our lawyers suggested that he did. And I suggest to the court that That is argued in every case that I have been involved in, and I suggest that you have been involved in as attorneys before your service here. It is an integral part of what is presented to the jury. It's an integral part of proximate cause. It's an integral part of damages. It just has not been totally wrapped around as a separate injury or as a separate cause of action.
Ms. Davis,
or as a separate instruction.
Let me follow up then. Why do you say this is such a critical issue public policy-wise on whether or not, I don't know, whether we recognize loss of chance or we say it's permissible to instruct the jury on it, or what is the significance about recognizing that in a medical negligence case, which is a failure to diagnose, that we recognize that a loss of chance is one of the elements that occurs here that could be damages. Let me start. Suppose Mrs. Kramer survives, but because of the misdiagnosis, suffers a different treatment, a more radical treatment that she would not have suffered but for the misdiagnosis. She could still be alive. Wrongful death doesn't apply. Why wouldn't loss of chance really be the element of liability that occurs that permits the Kramers to recover for this tremendous additional expense? She may survive at the other end and be fully going to remission or whatever. Why? What's so significant about loss of chance in that case?
Judge, the significance of it, as I view it from the standpoint of this case, is that the requested submission of loss of chance and the instruction on it was predicated on a finding of no to proximate cause. And so you are saying to the jury, now jury, if you can't find that the causation was probably caused by these defendants, can you find that it was possibly caused by these defendants? And not only that, Judge, we want the same damages, whether you find probability or possibility, or whether you find probability or improbability. And that is my major concern. My light's on. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Just one final question very briefly.
Yes.
Recognition of loss of chance with some standard of probability requirement be appropriate?
Judge Gamage, in our other lives, you and I both operated in a forum, you on one side of the table and me on the other, where those kinds of issues have the opportunity to be explored. And I suggest to this court that it is not inappropriate for the legislature to explore this issue to make that kind of a major change in my judgment. I guess I would urge that this court be very careful before it tried to make that without that kind of fact-finding ability that Justice Phillips suggested and asked us if we had seen performed. I have not seen it performed. Certainly a review of what all would be appropriate from an instruction standpoint would be the kind of thing that that kind of an exercise would be certainly helpful and begin to solidify the issues and thinking of probably all of us.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Governor. Thank you, Governor.
Counsel, if the loss of chance could be argued as under the court's proximate cause question and instruction, why isn't your submission, which is predicated on a no finding to proximate cause, merely a phase or shade of the proximate cause question prohibited under Rule 278?
May it please the court. Yes, Your Honor. I was present at the argument in this case. The issue of loss of chance was not argued. It was predicated on a no finding to proximate cause. The issue was on a proximate cause to the death. Our belief is that the injury
question,
in this case...
The question inquires proximate cause of the occurrence in question. You're saying that that is the death?
Absolutely. That's the way it was argued. There's never been any statement to the contrary that what we were talking about at that point in time was the death of Jenny Kramer. That's the way it was argued. That was the only thing I believe that we could have argued, because he disallowed, the court did, our questions on loss of chance. All the damage questions that were conditioned on it asked how much money would compensate Jenny Kramer for her death. It all went to the death. The jury understood it was death. They never were allowed to comprehend or understand the loss of chance issue. And I think that it is vitally important that this court recognize that the loss of chance itself is an injury. If Jenny Kramer had stripped from her a 30% chance, 40% chance, whatever the chance was, she had an injury taken from her. None of us would disagree, I don't believe, that if you had a chance taken from you, that was an injury. The issue for this court is whether that's a compensable injury. And I believe that this court, if we just look at the facts of what happened in this case, why do women go to a doctor for a pap smear in the first place? They go because they know if cancer is detected earlier, they have a better chance of survival. That's why they go.
Mr. Box, is it your position that the loss of chance has to be proximately caused by the negligence?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And Mr. Davis's position that if you allow the loss of chance to be the injury that's proximately caused, the result is to then allow recovery for the fact that there's a that this loss of chance increased the possibility of this injury. He was saying that what you're really saying is we want to be compensated where their negligence possibly caused the ultimate injury of death. Do you concede, well, let's say in the loss of chance cases, are the damages a factor of the percentage loss versus the actual damages, or are you claiming we want 100% of the damages if the loss of chance is proximate cause?
No, I think it's taken care of in the damages in our case. In our case, when we submitted the issues on damages, we did the best that we could at that time. We went according to what Jim Perdue suggested in his law review article. We used those issues. That's the best that we had. Loss of chance has developed a lot more in the last 3 years. The damage issues that we submitted had to deal with what would compensate Jenny Kramer for her loss of chance. If the jury found that that's a small loss of chance, then one would think those are going to be small damages. The way that Mr. Keith, in his recent law review article, has proposed it is quite fair. I believe he's proposed even a different method, such as what he calls the proportional method of damages. The proportional method of damages would hold that if you have a 15% reduction in your chance of survival, then the jury finds the total amount of damages, and you reduce it by that 15%.
When that goes over 50%, does the proportionalization continue?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Well, like you had a, it caused an 85% reduction.
Sure.
In chance.
I believe that's correct.
Is it still 85?
I believe that's correct under his analysis and his theory of the proportional damages. I think
so
that's correct.
So the doctor and the patient are always in a kind of a shared...
Well, it's going to cut both ways. It's not going to simply cut against the plaintiffs in this case. It's going to cut against, for the plaintiffs, it's going to cut to the defendants as well. Because I can envision situations in where a defendant can plead as an affirmative defense loss of chance, and where the defendant would be able to submit issues on loss of chance and have damages reduced. So I think this is a fair approach. I don't think that we're being unfair in this at all. The courts have wrestled with loss of chance in various contexts since 1917 in the state of Texas. In a case that's not cited in the brief that has been submitted, the Kansas City M&O Railroad case versus Bell, a hog farmer was sending his hogs to a prize contest. The railroad delayed in getting his hogs there. They lost weight. He won second place instead of first place, and he brought the suit. In that case, the court specifically held, to quote from the court in one line, the chance might be worth little or nothing, or it might be worth under some circumstances the full amount of premium. It would be left to the good sense of the jury trying the case to determine the value of the plaintiff's chance in this competition.
Did I understand Mr. Dean to say that negligence and proximate cause were submitted separately in this case?
That the issue of proximate cause was submitted, that's correct.
And what did the jury find as to negligence?
The jury found negligence on the hospital. The jury, in deference to Mr. Dean, the jury did find that the pathologist was negligent versus the other way around. The jury found no negligence on Frances Nightingale herself, but did find negligence on the hospital.
Doesn't that finding, with such bifurcated issues, end the case on Ms. Nightingale? I mean, we don't get to the causation and what degree.
She was not a defendant in the case, Your Honor. She was simply submitted as an employee under vicarious liability of the hospital.
But the hospital was found under a separate line.
That's correct. And I don't believe, incidentally, that would get rid of her, because another point of error we've raised is this experiment that we believe was harmful and led to an improper finding of no negligence on her part. That's the other point of error was raised.
Okay.
And why is loss of chance merely a reduction in life expectancy?
Why is it not? Well, because I think there have been other situations in which loss of chance has been recognized in the medical context. There's one case that comes to mind. I can't remember the style of it, but it involved the replacement of a knee or something in the individual. They found that had they gone ahead and done surgery sooner, then the person wouldn't have lost his leg or something to that extent. It's not. We're asking the court at this point to rule on the facts of this case, which is a death case. But there are other instances in which, with gross problems, disabilities of a patient, that it might also be applicable. And that's the reason I don't think it's simply a loss of survivability. It's a chance that you have, you see, because if you take a 30% chance away, that's 30% that person had that they were going to totally survive and live, a long, normal life.
Well, if the evidence is that Ms. Kramer would have lived 20 years had the diagnosis been made correctly and timely, but that she lived 8 months because of the negligence of the defendants, why can't the jury, under our present submission, and compensate her heirs for that reduction in life expectancy?
There's no way that I know, under our current system, to be able to compensate Mrs. Kramer under the evidence that was submitted in our case for a loss of chance. If the jury believes that she had, as Dr. Burroughs, which was their defense expert, stated, that she was possibly a stage 2 or stage 3 at the beginning, thus she went all the way to a stage 4, if the jury believed that testimony, they had no way to go from a stage 3 to a stage 4 based on what they heard. They had to find, more probably than not, that it caused her death, not a chance of survival or a loss of chance that was taken from her.
But if the defendant argues that her life expectancy would not have been extended, even if they had made the correct diagnosis, and the plaintiff argues that it would have been extended to a normal life expectancy or perhaps 20, somewhere in between, why doesn't that present the case to the jury so the jury can decide what damages followed from the negligence?
It seems to me that it's difficult to present it in such a way, given the facts of this case, that you could say more likely than not and come up with an answer in that regard. If they're saying more likely than not her life expectancy would have been 8 years, and we're saying based upon what happened, she died on X day, which we have facts that she did die in this case, and that she should have lived 20 years, then if we present that evidence, the jury is going to have to find under our present action that it more likely than not resulted in her death. I mean, there's no issue that I know of that would be able to be presented in this type of a death case that would, under current law, unless this court adopts what I feel like should be the law, that would allow recovery in that situation. I just don't see how that the issues could be phrased unless we adopt the loss of chance theory and say that that is the injury and recognize that it's a compensable injury.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.